Welcome to Talk Without Borders. I'm your host, Jean Petit. So, today is a small milestone. This is the 10th episode of the podcast, and I would like the opportunity to thank you for the support and thoughtful feedback so far. I started this show to have honest, engaging conversations with people who have ideas worth sharing, and so far, it's been a great experience for me. In this episode, I sit down with Sam Elsie, one of the youngest and I think most promising political voices in Luxembourg today. Sam just finished high school, but he's already made his mark as a youth parliament president and an outspoken advocate for stronger civic engagement and more opportunities for young people to get involved in politics. We talked about why so many young people tune out of politics and what it might take to change that. We also talked about Luxembourg's education system, misinformation, and the challenges of digital transformation. If you're enjoying these conversations, I'd really appreciate if you could subscribe, especially on YouTube, where we're close to reaching our first 100 subscribers. Your engagement, whether it's liking, sharing, or subscribing, helps us grow, reach new listeners, and keep bringing you meaningful discussions with interesting people. But now, enjoy my conversation with Sam Elsie. Hello, Sam. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for having me.
So first of all, I have to say you're my youngest guest so far, by far, I would say. If I remember, we had a text conversation earlier, and I think you told me that you are finishing your high school exams. Is that correct?
Exactly. I finished them recently. I was told 2 days ago that I passed, actually.
So, oh, you did already?
Yeah.
Is that fast?
Yeah, I was one of the lucky ones who received their results early.
Okay.
And now looking forward to university and moving on.
How did it go? Can you say what your grade was? Is that too private?
I haven't received the exact grades yet.
Okay.
Just like the overall mention that I did well enough and that I passed the year.
That's the most important thing.
Okay.
If I may ask, what section did you go to? Because I remember.
I went to the classic section and then first the economy part for 2 years, and now the last year I switched over to social sciences, geography, and history.
Oh, is that the G? Is that correct?
Exactly.
It's been a long time for me, but I still remember that. Well, congratulations. So I don't know how old you are exactly, but I would just assume you're 18 or 19.
I'm 19. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's pretty impressive. So that's a good bridge we can make because you're quite active on social media and in the political scene in Luxembourg at such an early age. So how did you become so involved? What did lead up to you being so involved?
I would say the first thing would be my family context. I've always been one who's loved to debate, and I've got a brother who's just as competitive as I am. And so from an early age onwards, we would have the most random debates about whatever. And after time, we just both started, informing ourselves as to win against the other person. And so that slowly snowballed into reading the newspaper every single day, trying to be as informed as possible. And we would basically have daily debates. Then, this is a long story, but at the beginning of the pandemic, I was supposed to have a boat tour in Croatia. And even though the first pandemic restrictions were starting to go ahead, we still decided, let's do it. And school was on our side. Problem was, at one point, it turned out that I was positive. So in the midst of being on a boat in Croatia, suddenly I'm positive. The whole boat had to quarantine. So we had 7 people on that boat who had to quarantine together. And at that point, we decided to talk a lot. We didn't have much to do. And at the time, I was lucky enough to meet the president of the Luxembourg Youth Parliament at the time, who was on the boat. We had very deep discussions from politics, society, and so on. And at the end, he suddenly just said, join the Youth Parliament. And from that point onwards, that was the first step. And I would say that on one side, the Youth Parliament itself shaped me a lot. I became its president. At one point, I had lofty ambitions for it, which I was able to put into practice. But at the same time, I also discovered this bubble. And that bubble is Luxembourgish youth politics, where there's a lot of opportunities, but very, very few people actually engaging with them. And so those people who get engaged get recruited into a whole lot of other movements. An example would be there were a few EU-wide youth opportunities. In France, you'd have 1,000 people apply to the worst opportunity there was, up to 500,000 for the best of them. In Luxembourg, you'd have 7 people applying. So in Luxembourg, once you are in that bubble, and I was lucky enough to, through on one side the fact of wanting to win against my brother and being informed about politics, having an easy way in, but then at the same time having a few friends who are then making it easier to be into the bubble, or get into the bubble quite early and then have all the benefits of it over quite a long while.
Okay, so before getting into the youth engagement in politics, I think that's really important to discuss. Just back to, because you said you love to debate and you debated your brother. When you look at debates and you prepare yourself for a debate, is your primary goal to win the debate, or is it more something more secondary, like just trying to get a great conversation? So what's your goal when you're debating?
I believe it always depends on the context. I'd say when I'm debating with my brother, of course, the main goal is to win. That's brotherly love. When it comes to larger debates, be it in the youth parliament, be it in other political organizations, it's always to, on one side, come as possible, as close as possible to the truth. So, of course, empirical truth is hard to find, but it's more of a discussion between sources and trying to contrast which position is the best from as factual standpoint as possible. But of course, it really depends in which context you are. If you are debating against a person, and sadly I've had quite a lot of experience with that, who's propagating disinformation, who has certain opinions which go against your fundamental values, then it truly shifts to a different type of debate. So it really depends on context, but the ones I like the most are ones where you have two constructive sides just trying to find the best solution together.
So tell me about the youth parliament. For the listener that maybe hasn't heard about it, how does the youth parliament work? What's the main idea behind it, and what do you contribute to it?
So I was active in the youth parliament from 15 to last year, 18, and last year I was its president. And since then I've handed in the reins and I've now a bit moved on. But for me, it's truly the stairs into politics, or at least engagement in Luxembourg. It's for people from between the ages of 14 to 24. Once you become a member, you then get a lot of other activities from other organizations proposed to you, so events, social stuff and so on. So that's one of the advantages. But at the same time, there's 5 commissions in the Luxembourg Youth Parliament. And so these commissions go from economy, environment, foreign affairs and so forth. And each year they decide to write a resolution. So each year of being a member of the Youth Parliament, you'll be a member of at least one commission, and then write a resolution together with people with vastly different backgrounds, cultures, political opinions and so forth. And the idea then is to create the most factual and convincing resolution on a youth-related topic as possible. And then at the end of the year, you present it to the Chamber of Deputies and try to convince them to basically put it into place, or at least consider it.
Is the idea to mimic the political process in Luxembourg for young people? Is that the main idea behind it?
To a certain degree, but I would say that it's a bit its own unique thing. It's not necessarily, some people describe it as the little sister of the Chamber of Deputies. I would tend to disagree. There's still big differences. Everyone can join. You don't have to be elected to join. You work on one resolution a year, unlike the Chamber of Deputies where you have multiple. But yeah, I mean, the general idea when it was set up was truly to be the youth parliament, so the smaller version of the grown-up parliament.
So since you have quite a lot of experience in debating with a lot of other young people, especially in the youth parliament, well, I would assume that the people that come to the youth parliament or engaged in the youth parliament are also very engaged politically, I would assume, right? So they care a lot about politics, they care a lot about being engaged, participating in society in a constructive way. But I think you mentioned it earlier, when you compared Luxembourg to France, it seems to me there is quite a bit of a problem in Luxembourg.
I believe you have in my opinion, a very sad engagement profile in Luxembourg politics, that is politics as a whole, as well as youth politics, where it's often the same schools, the same backgrounds, the same people. I'm a stereotype of that problem. I was talking before of the bubble. I'm exactly the kind of person who's typical for that bubble, and at least I'm aware of it. But Luxembourg youth politics truly is a small group of people working together, recruiting from the same schools from where they're from, and that repeats itself. The Luxembourg Youth Parliament for quite a while had presidents from my school. At the same time, there are efforts to change that. When I was the president, I was trying to go, for example, to international schools, to schools which do not fit the traditional stereotype of people being engaged. Problem is, that hasn't necessarily been repeated year after year. And also, a youth parliament, or in general, youth politics can be elitist from its nature, because the topics you discuss are often nationwide topics. And for example, if you're addressing pension reform, and then suddenly you have youngsters reading into what is pension reform, versus then your
it seems to just us taking on the point of pension. It seems to me also for young people, they're just so far from the pension that they might think, well, that doesn't really concern me because I'm 18, 19, 20, right? So why do I care about my pension? So is that something that you see as well?
Yeah, I would agree. I believe, again, you've got this really big split on one side, people who are immensely engaged, who are immensely informed, and who know that, well, this reform will affect us the most in the long term. But then you've got a big part of the population which does not have this access to reliable political information, to getting an idea of what politics is, and therefore these topics just go over their head. And this would also be a big criticism on my side towards the education we receive in school. If I discount all my education in the non-formal area and I just look at my political education in the formal area, honestly, if it weren't for the initiative of some amazing teachers that I had, I would know, and sorry for the word, fuck all about Luxembourg politics. And for me, I find that immensely, it certainly scares me, because education is the front line of democracy. It's there where you build the habits which ensure a strong democracy, people who live democracy understand democracy. And as of now, I mean, we have certainly have better lessons on democracy than Germany, Belgium, or France, which says more about their education system than it does from ours. But you get, in all of your school years, you get one lesson in your fourth final year about civic education, where a big part of it is more discovering the constitution and not what is democracy and actually getting examples from it. A lesson which is more shaped, again, by the actions taken of the teacher and not a national-wide lesson plan. So in that sense, there's definitely a massive gap between people who get into non-formal education, where there's lots of opportunities, where they learn a lot, versus those who don't.
I very much agree with you, because I'm reflecting on my own high school career, which has been a while. And I think you're right. I think I had 1 year of civic instruction, and that wasn't really that interesting either. So what are the reasons, in your view, for the education system to not stress this education on civic matters more? Do you think it's on purpose? Maybe they don't care, or they don't think it's that important. So what do you think is the reason for discarding that, I guess, in a sense?
I would say it's a bit of a combination. On one side, it wasn't necessarily always that evident. I mean, if you look at it, even the generation of my parents grew up learning about the history of Luxembourg, be it in school, be it at home, of the people who fought for democracy in Luxembourg. Their parents were people who had survived or lived through the Second World War, or there was still some family memory of it. So democracy was so normal that there was no necessary meaning of teaching it in school, because everyone knows it. Now we are in a moment of crisis. We've got an international situation where demagogues and tyrants are trying to take over democracies across the whole globe, supported by those demagogues and tyrants who are already in place. And combined with, I mean, if you look at Europe, we've had almost persistent crises for 10 years now, from the 2015 migration crisis to Brexit to the pandemic to the Ukraine war. And now if you look at the past few months, it certainly hasn't become any more stable.
Yeah, the Israel. Now we got the Israel-Iran war, so added to that.
Yeah, and I mean, India-Pakistan as well. It's just gone on and on and on. And our socio-economic situation has become far worse. The fabric and the social deal with which a lot of European countries have been built, where a lot of people, and I would say about one-fourth of people who are eligible to vote in most countries don't vote. Why? Because not only do they not necessarily see a reason, but it's also part of their social deal, where they say, okay, I won't go to vote as long as my life is not affected by politics. And now a lot of these voters who usually stay out of politics, which again is not necessarily good for politics, but they are coming into politics for the wrong reasons, motivated by the fact that politics has not been able to deliver the right responses to them. And so you have the rise of left and right-wing populist parties. You have, or in general, I would rather qualify all of them as populists, mainly just populist parties who try to provide simple answers to problems which absolutely do not necessitate simple answers, which will only get worse.
Do we have that in Luxembourg as well, the rise of right-wing or left-wing parties?
I would say we've been able to dampen it down through the fact that we're a small country. I mean, it's a criticism against the government right now. I would partially even agree to it. But there's always been strong social dialogue. And if you say that the government does not talk to the people, well, it does 1,000 times more than in any other country. If you're a bit lucky, you'll walk into Savio Buttel having a coffee in town in the morning. Politics is close to people in Luxembourg. The problem is that even here in Luxembourg, there are some who have absolutely been radicalized, and you don't need many for it to become extremely dangerous. I criticized Kartheiser for going the MEP for populist party in Luxembourg and for going to Russia I won't go into this whole topic, but anyway, I received death threats afterwards in Luxembourgish. So some Luxembourger created an account on TikTok and in Luxembourgish started writing to me, "Go kill yourself." And that we're at this point in Luxembourg. Yes, electorally, we still got a margin, a defense of democracy, so to say, left. But still, that even here in Luxembourg, we've come to this point is a measure of sadness.
So I just want to piggyback on that, because you said that you got death threats. And I've heard that quite a lot when I talk to politicians in Luxembourg. And I think it's somewhat coupled to social media, right? People have, in a way, I would assume for a politician, social media is both a blessing because it allows you to communicate with so many people from different sectors of the population. But it is also a little bit of a curse sometimes, because people can also use it the same way to attack you or to spread misinformation, etc. So how do you deal with this imbalance in this social media?
For me, social media has always been far more an opportunity than it has been a curse, so to say. I've used it to create, for example, a LinkedIn newsletter, an Instagram channel, and a few other medias with whom I then can share youth opportunities to wider audiences. So in that sense, it has also helped me try to achieve many of my political goals in the youth parliament. I mean, as a consultative organization, your main power is actually having a voice. And so social media in part allowed us to reach a lot of the change makers through Luxembourg. And especially in a country so small as Luxembourg, where you know a lot of people, having the right social medias can be the determining factor of having success or not. So I would say it's definitely more of an opportunity than there's a threat. But at the same time, you have to adapt yourself. I mean, I've got dark humor. I'm ready to admit it. I cannot use my normal political account to watch any reels, because there's been some people who would then be looking at what I would like or what I would be watching to then use against me. Or there'd be people who say, look at who's following him. Is he associated with this kind of person? Or again, people who look at your content.
Yeah, there's always a footprint. Yeah,
exactly. Footprint, so on one side, as a person trying to engage yourself, it's a threat in the sense of you have to pay a lot of attention because there's lots of people from all sides, in a sense, are ready to harm you or at least want to, not necessarily want the best for you. And then on the other hand, you've always also got direct political enemies or people who are just opposed to you, where you have to pay attention when you post things. So I pay attention to never post something when I'm not at home with a video of me being somewhere else, or with the background which would reveal where I am, or even responding to a lot of messages, because sometimes I get messages where I think, oh wow, this is a nice person just trying to ask a question, and then it turns out it's just someone who wants to send me some nasty texts. So it's, again, it's a blessing and it's a curse. It really depends today. I'd say if you have thick skin, and I had a lot of bad experiences at the start, so I was able to shield myself, and now I've gotten used to it. But I'd say it's also sad because I know a lot of youngsters who easily got discouraged from getting into politics. And in general, politics has gotten this dark, ugly image on two sides. On one side, from the public, then people believe that you're a politician or you must be corrupt. Like, I pay attention to in which context I mention to people that I'm active in political engagement, because certain people are going to just look at you judgingly. And then at the same time, it's also gotten this bad image for people who are passionate, where it's just, oh, it's so much work, it's so much hate. Alone in the social sector in Luxembourg, with different associations and so on, you have so many smart people who have passionate for a number of different movements, and who would be better than most politicians which I've met, and who'd absolutely do a fabulous job if they went politics. But they are so scared of politics because of the image politics has gotten that they don't. And that's also, for me, it's sad. It's blocking us as a country, and it's not only a Luxembourgish effect, that's for sure.
So the next question is twofold. So first of all, since you're part of the Gen Z generation, I think, well, I'm a millennial, so we were already told that we are lazy, that we are uninspired, that we're not motivated, you know, we don't have a work ethic. And I feel like it's even worse now for your generation, you know, who a lot of times I feel like the first prejudice or impression is always one of these descriptions. So what first of all, do you think there's some truth to that? Or what is your view on this as a member of the Gen Z generation who is actually quite involved in politics?
I would first try to relativize it, because I remember it's been 2 years now where I had to translate a Latin text of more than 2,000 years ago of Cicero criticizing the young generation for being so lazy.
Oh, God, it already happened 2,000 years ago. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So it's not something necessarily new. I would say there's some truth to it, but by far no total one. When it comes to politics, I fundamentally disagree. In my experience, what youngsters need is what every generation needed. It's a small push at the start. I've met a lot of people who, when given the chance to engage themselves, they were like, this isn't for me. Oh, wow, this wonderful opportunity. Oh, I'm not good enough. So self-doubt, exactly then when they shouldn't doubt themselves. And the moment where they got pushed a little, they had a person, a teacher, a role model who said, hey, go on. I mean, in the youth parliament, it was that we told people we have cake during the meetings. And then they show up for the cake, and then they'd see the discussion, they'd see the debate, they'd see the topic, they'd engage themselves, a fire started in them, and that was all it took. And then suddenly you have some of the people who are now the most active in the Luxembourg Youth Parliament and other organizations who started out as youngsters doubtful of themselves. And all it took was that small push at the start. On the other hand, what I would agree with is that especially Gen Z is all about efficiency. I mean, if I get told to do this job this way, the first thing I'll do is I'll ask ChatGPT, how can I do it more efficiently? So I'd say it's definitely a more autonomous worker.
Or maybe a lack of patience, maybe?
Maybe both, yeah. I would agree, actually. I mean, we are the digital generation. We grew up with a phone where everything went fast, so we're also used to that. So it comes with advantages and disadvantages. Advantages in the sense that we'll always try to find the most efficient situation. On the other hand, it can also be disadvantage in the sense of if you have long, hard working hours and so on. But again, I would also try to stay away from generalizing, because I've met so many youngsters who go in all directions, where you've got certain people who are immensely industrious and others who are immensely lazy. But when I compare it to the generations which came before us, I barely see a difference with most of them. So
I think there's tremendous potential amongst young people, and I think, like you said, that it might be a problem of motivation, or people are just flat out discouraged because, as you said before, a lot of politics is dominated by the same people, right? And so they dominate the narrative. And I think it might be a little discouraging for the young generation. But I wanted to jump on that point. So since you are a digital native, what do you think about the current policy when it comes to Luxembourg's digital progress? So where do you think we are? What are the issues, and where could we go if we change them?
So this is actually a topic which I'm quite passionate about from my own experience, but also from what I've seen throughout Luxembourg. I would say one first has to divide it into public and private. So in private, what you have is you have certain front runners, which are especially those firms which have the global reach, respectively, the competences to truly digitize. And they are some of the best we have, not only in the country, but on the continent. But then what you especially have in Luxembourg are small to medium enterprises, especially those in sectors, real estate, whatever, where for a long time, everything has just been quite, not necessarily stagnant, but the way they've been working has always worked. And they don't necessarily see the reason to upgrade to digital, to digitize, which can in certain cases be horrendous because our productiveness as a whole economy goes down and it's just useless in that sense. But there's just not enough incentive for them to upgrade, which of course also means that in case there's ever a big shock or there's a new player which arrives from the international scene which has already digitized, they're far more productive. So in that sense, I see a trap for our small to medium enterprises where they are not necessarily being supported enough to undergo the whole digital transformation, but they also don't necessarily have the reason to do so. It would cost them far more than any subsidy could give them. But this is also at the same time strengthened from the fact that the institutions with whom they work or where they have to, for example, send the documents into, the ones from the state, are horrendous as well when it comes to digitalization. And in the state alone, you have a lot of different categories, ministries, institutions who all work differently. Technically, you have a ministry of digitalization.
Which is more education, higher education, right? Also,
yeah, exactly.
It combines the two, yeah.
So technically, that one there should have a proper strategy for all groupings of the state and beyond to digitize.
When you say technically, that you mean they don't?
I believe they do, but I believe that putting into practice is very, very slow. I've barely noticed them. And I believe that they don't live up to the slogan of Luxembourg of let's make it happen, because we should be an innovation capital. We've got a country like Estonia where you can vote electronically, where you basically receive everything from the government digitally, where you have a MyGishe app which actually includes all your interactions with the state and not just a handful. So for me, we're a quarter there. We've got a lot of good initiatives, but we've just placed the fundamentals, and somehow it's taken us so long to move beyond that initial phase, but international partners aren't waiting. And so I see it as, on one side, a definite issue for everyone. It's something where you can make the state easier to work for everyone. Everyone suddenly knows where to ask which documents. It becomes easier. There's less geographical limits and so forth. And at the same time, it's also good for productiveness. And also, in my opinion, it can make opportunities and engagement far more open, especially for youngsters, because who's on the web? Us youngsters. An idea I pitched not too long ago, which who knows where it will go, was to create an application from the state with all the engagement possibilities for youngsters on a single app. Because right now you've got thousands of different places. Every institution is doing their own thing. But if you would have one central place where every youngster gets a notification at the morning in school and gets told, here you can engage.
I think that's an interesting idea. So where do you go? Who do you contact when you propose an idea? Do you go to the Minister of Digitalization, or who did you pitch this to?
A few agencies. So in the Youth Council, in the National Youngsters Service, and in speaking to Minister of Education. It's a long way off from becoming a reality. So.
Did you get a reply? Did people engage with your inquiry?
As it seems, they're interested. They've got their own initiatives. So that's also something which I'm hopeful, and why I say so. That's one of the reasons why I'm in general hopeful for Luxembourg. Is it's small enough that even I, as a low level youngsters, let's say, just a youth politician who's been interested, can reach some directors, ministers in this country and pitch my ideas. It's even if they won't accept them, at least I had the opportunity to do so. And as it seems, they're working on similar initiatives, and they'll include the feedback. But yeah, so I'm hopeful in that sense, but it's definitely an issue with digitization where for more than 10 years now, everyone has said we're going to continue. And for more than 10 years, it's been more of a sideshow, the kind of ministry you get as a prestige thing and not an actual meaningful ministry in any other sense. At least this is my impression.
I have the same impression that there's a lot of performance, a lot of things are said, not a lot of things are done. And I always say, if you want to know how serious your government takes something, look at who they appointed as the person in charge. And I think if you go look at the Minister of Digitalization, who's actually a doctor in her private life. So I feel like, there are quite a lot more people that might be more qualified for that position. Maybe they might have a background in tech. They have a background in, technology, something related to this. I think that is very much necessary, for the country to make a change.
I would partially agree. On the other hand, I also find that it's interesting in certain cases when you have different experience. So, for example, something which is happening now is that doctors are starting to become digitalized. And this is one of the where the CNS is starting to do it, and with doctors it is going in that direction. So I'd say bringing experience from different sectors can help. But for me, what's missing is an overarching, not only strategy, but vision. For me, we would need something like Luxembourg 2035. We want to be further ahead than the Estonians. Or we want to have voting electronically and have tried to take all the domains of public life and per domain have a separate vision where you say, okay, here we want this, here we want this. As of now, I don't see it happening. And yes, there were...
So why not? Why not? Why has it, because you said for 10 years, you feel like there's a missing initiative. So in your view, what is the point that's holding back a government to move into that direction?
I would say there's been a lot of different visions from different people coming into this position. It's never been assigned as the most important. It's always just been a thing on the side, so to say. And for the rest, it's always... Digitization is also a strange subject because it touches everything. And so that's also another problem which I see where every ministry is doing it on their own. In education, I mean, this is my school iPad. So I've been able to have a digitization from the Ministry of Education. But how does this affect the economy and other ministries? Each ministry is doing it a bit on their own. And in my opinion, at least, and again, here it really depends per minister and per term we're speaking, but as of now, I don't believe there's a overarching vision which transcends political parties, and that definitely has to be worked on. But it also takes political courage and also political necessity, because also other topics have just been so much more pressing, more present for the average citizen, that in that sense, it's a low-level priority, which is absolutely sad.
So you think that it is a low-level priority for the current government. So do you think at some point it will become a top priority, if at some point maybe it's too late?
It's a hard question to answer, but I would say that it will not necessarily be a top priority, but it will continue to be something which is worked on the side. So it will be completed, there will be milestones reached, but I just don't see us becoming a front runner. So I don't see us becoming the first to digitalize everything and be even before Estonia. I just see us being a country which moves along the rest in a quite steady pace. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's not a priority at all for this government. It's just like any other administrative task, it's done on the side. Some changes are going to be done, but we're not going to run a marathon to absolutely get it done as soon as possible.
Okay, so I want to switch the conversation a little bit to disinformation. If we talked a little bit about it earlier, with the rise of social media, especially young people consuming more and more news, be it through YouTube or online news. So the more traditional, you know, television, people sit down at 8 p.m. and they watch the news, right? As people get older, you know, this is a consumption behavior that's going to die out. And now we have this online environment, right, that's creating the news. So as a young person and as a politician, how do you see this affecting us being informed? And what are the risks, right? Because there are a lot of risks, I think, in terms of misinformation. So I guess what is good about it and what do you think is bad about it?
I mean, the good parts about it are the movements you can see spreading through, and I would qualify them as the progressive movements you can see on online, the Me Too movement and other similar movements, which absolutely helped in the sense of that a lot of people got together, they brought a message together, and this had an actual impact, or helping Ukraine also in part was motivated through social media factors where people saw what was happening and were spontaneously starting to help the Ukrainians, be by material aid, pressuring their politicians. So there's a lot of good things which can come from it. At the same time, what I'm scared about most is not natural organic disinformation, because a lot of people spread disinformation without necessarily knowing so. They misinterpret the scene, they start talking about things that they aren't necessarily informed about. And there, I'm not that scared of organic disinformation. I would call it organic disinformation itself. I'm scared about it being amplified. And the problem you have is you have more and more bot farms, which are often also used from, for example, Russia or other countries which absolutely want to destroy our democracies. They are supported by a very populist podcast show, so I'm happy to be on a good podcast and not on Joe Rogan. So things like that.
Well, I want to jump, because I think it's a little bit sad, because I used to listen to Joe Rogan. I remember I was at university. I used to listen to him a lot, and I thought he was actually quite good in the beginning. He had a lot of interesting conversations, but then I think, unfortunately, around the COVID time, I think he kind of like slipped into a little bit of a right wing era of, you know, anti-vax and anti, you know, so, and then I feel like he radicalized himself more and more. And yeah, now I feel like, unfortunately, he's become a bit of a megaphone for the fringe right, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I used him as a spiral, but I would say that it's actually happening to quite a lot, especially in America, but you can even see it in Europe slowly starting, is this downward spiral where lots of people who start out as people really wanting to do something good or had their good podcast, radicalization happens so fast, and especially to those who are immensely present on the web, who work in the web and so on, who are then slowly starting to get pulled into a web of disinformation. And the problem is also the way algorithms are built. As soon as you get into an echo chamber, it's very hard to get out. And that's the point where I wanted to get to afterwards is it's immensely easy to radicalize a person. It's immensely hard to pull them out. In the youth parliament, I was working with people from all political spectrums. It's also the beauty of the youth parliament is that it's bipartisan by nature. So you'll be working with people from all shades of life, all political spectrums. But what I saw there were certain youngsters which we were trying to recruit who had at one point slipped down this spiral, be it a TikTok they watched for too long, and then afterwards their feed started giving them more and more and more of the same contact until they were slowly sliding into this position, and where it was basically hard to get them out. And again, this is being amplified by bot farms, by certain people who have absolutely an agenda and are absolutely working against, be it freedom of speech or the right to proper information.
Yeah, I think the most difficult thing right now is that I think you have a lot of bad faith actors who are really smart, especially if you look at the US, the right wing, they're really smart. And I think that's actually how they won the election, is through mobilizing the social media space, the alternative media space, amplifying messages, right? Like the culture wars is one example, and so on. So that was hugely effective. So my guess is, as someone like you, someone like me, who is interested in the truth, in creating a democratic space, in having institutions that work for the people and not against them. But I think like the whole Trump era, and he has kind of like muddied the water so that people don't really know what is true anymore, you know, what is fabrication, because Trump will be able to say the New York Times and CNN is fake news, but Alex Jones is like the greatest journalist that ever walked on earth, right? So, and people believe him. So I guess my question is, how do you get, and you just mentioned it yourself, the radicalization process is hard. It's really hard to get out of. So what is your suggestion? How do you think we can get out of that?
The first thing I wanted to get back on is, I've forgotten the exact name, but there's the term of the, I believe it's Orthon window. That what is
the Overton window.
What is acceptable to talk about in a democracy? And in my reflection, I believe that more than one exists by now, where in most democracies you have more and more of a split, where certain people more and more, and that's also not necessarily good, but they go more and more into the phase of you're not only allowed to say certain things which don't offend certain people. And then you've got a different direction of people who have basically the same movement, just that it's going into a different direction, where you've got two different realities, two different perceptions of democracy which are starting to exist, which are polar opposite in nature. However, what I believe one has to try to find is the common ground. So there's always still some part which overlaps. For me, that's every time I was starting to debate someone who would disagree with my views, disagree with, an example would be the right to vote for people from 16 onwards in Luxembourg. So that is a big discussion for youth parliaments, of course, essential. Yeah, lots of youngsters being pro and against, but it was always a fun discussion. So whatever your opinion was, you could have a fun discussion. And every time we would start this discussion, the first thing I would try to do is, what are your fundamental values? My fundamental values are those of democracy. But if you're starting to debate with someone and then you find out that their fundamental value of democracy is a totally different perception than yours, where they see, for example, an example for me would be, I believe in a state which is separated from religion. So I would never in a debate take religion as the fact of my argument being right and his wrong or whatever.
Wait, are you talking about someone who thinks that church and state should not be separated? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. This would be one example where if you cannot even define fundamental values, then it's impossible to have a fundamental debate on certain issues, or it becomes immensely hard in that sense. So for me, the first step is try to find something you can agree on, and then work up from there, try to find what are the points of contention, and then on that point, work on it. On the other, it's also, and this is the, so this would be in a setting where you have time to talk to someone and you really have the time to do it. But on the other hand, in social media, the problem is social media is a public forum, but not one where one person has a megaphone, but where everyone has a megaphone, and whoever shouts loudest is the one people listen to. And it's a sad fact. One cannot change the algorithm as a simple actor. One has to hope that certain changes are being done, respectively, that there's certain legislations which get passed. But the fact is, if you're on social media, you partially have to play the game on social media. And that is to be loud, to present your message. And that's also a big question which you then have to ask yourself, which I ask myself every single day, is how can I remain a proper democratic person, remain close to my core values, which are everything except populism, at the same time manage to reach people on a populist application? And that's something I've been working on since I've entered politics. It's the reason why a thing I do, for example, is sometimes I make provocative, I would call them, videos. But then in the links beneath, there's a very full and detailed explanation.
So yeah, but what they call it, the clickbait. They call it the clickbait. And I don't think it's necessarily a negative. There's a lot of great content creators in the US, for example, which I really like. When you listen, I really like their content, but the way they promote it is very clickbaity. And I think one of them even said, yes, I have to do this because this is what gives me the clicks and what gets me the engagement. I think that's what you were talking about, right?
Exactly. It's sad because you don't necessarily want to do it, but you are forced by the nature of the application to do it. But again, I mean, for now, I believe that it's gone quite well. It's often that I just have to try to have a really good hook within the first 10 seconds of a video. Otherwise, all of the Gen Zs are going to go. So that's for sure.
Well, that's another point. So how do you reach this Gen Z generation who is really used to short content? It has to be grabbing their attention right away. Well, we can name like TikTok, right? It's like, oh, six videos, somebody's dancing, you know, something, you know, and they scroll and they scroll and they scroll and, oh no, this is boring, move on, right? So how do you deal with this, I want to say, short attention span that keeps getting shorter and shorter, right?
I would say it's a buzzword, but stay innovative. For me, what worked certain years does not work at all anymore. So I've always tried to adapt my content. Sometimes I also on purpose make content as they did a few years ago, or I use references to things which are far more millennial culture than they are Gen Z, because the best way to reach young people is to subvert expectations. So the trick is either play their game in the 10 first seconds or even less, 5 first seconds of the video. You have to have a hook, something which reels them in and keeps them there. And that can either be something which they don't expect whatsoever, so something which is so out of the ordinary, or sometimes even just so ordinary that it absolutely captures people, or you go into a completely different path and you try to really do something which is spectacular and which just keeps them engaged.
So are there some topics that, from your experience in maybe experimenting with your social media strategy, that you see young people are reacting to really well and they engage with it? And then other topics they don't engage. And also, for example, I would imagine, like, if you talk about the, you know, Hamas versus Israel conflict or Ukraine-Russia war, maybe young people, this is not like their priority, or the pension reform. I feel like a lot of topics would probably, on most young people's mind, would be very low on their list.
I actually would disagree. I found that a lot of youngsters are less interested, and that's a bit from where this whole stereotype comes from. A lot of youngsters are less interested in politics as a whole. So you'll have less youngsters coming into the room and saying, I've got this opinion on that, this on that, this on that. But you have a lot more youngsters who are immensely informed on certain specific topics. And then suddenly they'll be basically experts. So be it on Ukraine, be it on Israel and Hamas. I've got a lot of friends who were never interested in geopolitics, then this war happened, and this was which kickstarted them into making their own research. Or climate change. That was especially with Fridays for Future, where half of my generation was tossed into this whole debate, where a lot of them, of course, moved on, but we still got a massive amount of youngsters where they're not necessarily interested in politics, but you talk to them about climate change, and they would be able to just generate an essay on it better than ChatGPT.
Yeah, so I just pick up on this point of youth engagement. So you still said there's still a very small amount of young people that are engaged in politics relatively. So what would be your strategy for getting more people, more young people into politics?
So the first thing would be schools. As of now, what I've been doing, so as I mentioned earlier, I have my own newsletter on LinkedIn and on Instagram. I've got multiple different organizations where I've taken it on as a personal task to share opportunities. And you've got numerous groupings throughout Luxembourg, the Youth Council, the Youth Parliament, the SNJ, the Ministry of Education, Eurodesk. I could name, I'd say, at least five more who all independently share information. What needs to happen is not only that they get centralized, but also that you use existing institutions to funnel these informations to the youngsters. So the youth centers in the communes, the schools, be it primary, be it secondary. I believe that schools, the nature of school has changed. Education, as said before, has to really take on the mantle of also being a protector and teacher of democracy. And therefore, one cannot have lessons. One cannot have a school without also including better civic education, but then also at the same time working hand in hand with non-formal education. So at the end of a lesson about, I don't know, politics, there's suddenly, hey, if you're interested further on this topic, take a look at the Luxembourg Youth Parliament, stuff like that. Where as of now, the connection between formal and non-formal education, especially when it comes to socio-economic engagement or socio-political, is, and that's the hardest part, is very strong in certain schools. And those are often schools in town. Those are the schools who have the most resources anyway. So these youngsters get all the opportunities. And that's also a form of inequality. Because I have the potential to meet with ministers. I have the potential to meet with directors, to be on this podcast. My engagement has directly led me, every single decision has led me to this. And as of now, it reinforces existing social inequalities because, for example, there was a statistic which looked at if you are a Portuguese person living in Luxembourg, what is the chance that after primary school, you are redirected to a technique secondary school, which is perceived worse than the classic school, and it scores far, far higher. Now, which schools are those who have the most resources, who are the most connected with other engagement types and so forth, mainly classic schools. And again, even there, there's differences between those who are in town and those who aren't. So you've got people who are traditionally already in a worse social position, who then go to schools who have less resources, which also have a worse connection to social engagement. So in that sense, it saddens me that as of now, political and social political engagement can become a factor of inequality and not be one of the factor which works against it. And therefore, one would need a far greater connection between schools, between the formal and non-formal sector. But also here, what I find sad is there is no one vision or one strategy. You've got a lot of independent small actors, even actors like me, who are trying to make the situation better. But instead of having something like a central vision, a central idea, strategy which guides it forward, it's done by all these little partners, but none of them has the actual strength to do it alone. And so what one needs is a form of pact, a form of platform between them, which can guide it.
So beyond the need for more education in that space, or more diversity, more access to information, do you think the government is doing enough to do outreach to young people?
In certain cases, yes. I believe what the government is doing perfectly in Luxembourg, where we have an immense privilege, is providing the information. But what they're not doing well is reaching the youngsters. So what the government does perfectly is create marvelous website, create marvelous magazines and so on with all the information you could need. But for some reason, and I think it's mainly because of an an issue of believing that the youngsters have to do it themselves, which is to in a part legitimate, but at the same time it hinders some people from actually getting engaged, is the fact of reaching out to people. So they what they do perfectly is creating the information, displaying it, but just not displaying it in the right places where youngsters are. And there again, you need a better strategy. And I honestly, something I would like to mention on this whole point.
So they're not doing a good job at reaching out to young people.
No, they are, okay. Certain actors are. But yeah, again, they're doing a good job in providing the information, just not providing it to youngsters.
Okay. And how could they change that? So you say they have the information, they have good content, but they're just not good at communicating it to young people for whatever reason? Is that the idea?
Exactly. I would say it's in one part, again, you have too many actors with different strategies, so it needs to be one strategy. And also employ some Gen Z. That's also the other part. I say that the best people to actually contact Gen Z would be other youngsters. And they're also the strategies you have from the ministries often too professional. When I see a video which is done professionally on TikTok, I believe it's an ad and I swipe away. So what you need are people who are on the ground, who know what the sector looks like, instead of people who, and sorry for placing the stereotype here, but people who couldn't be further away from the youngsters who are sitting in some dusty office.
In the ivory tower, yeah.
Exactly.
They call it. So for your vision, you know, as a young person looking into the future, you know, we don't have to define it, let's say if you look into your crystal ball 5-10 years down the road, what would you hope for? What would be the best case for you, how Luxembourg develops, especially in the context of the European Union, and what would be a really bad way?
So I'm a firm believer in the European project. I would also consider myself a European federalist, especially as a Luxembourger. We are such a small country. We have nothing to say, and it's something we often Luxembourgers forget. We have nothing to say on the international stage were it not for the European project. The European Union gives us a voice. The European Union gives us protection, gives us a proper market which actually accounts something in the world and is not just some miniature peck somewhere in Europe. So for me, the European project is the most beautiful thing you could have done. We've transformed the continent with the most wars ever into the most peaceful continent there has ever been. Even though we have conflicts on the peripheries, we have never been as peaceful. What's sad now is that this European project, and we talked about it, the crises we've been having for the last 10 years, the European project is a project of peace. At the same time, it was also built for peace. So it was never prepared to be in a situation of conflict. That's why NATO existed. The sad fact is that as of now, with NATO becoming unreliable, with a lot of different issues throughout the alliance, so with a lot of different divergences in the alliance itself, you don't have this common vision anymore as to what are we as NATO. And hence, the European project has to step up and become its own independent, in my opinion, country. If it becomes a country now or in 50 years, I do not care.
You're saying that you want the European Union to become a country?
Yes, I would. I'm a firm believer in federalism, so United States of Europe. How exactly this would look?
Is that a common position? Because I haven't encountered that a lot in Europe.
Well, I'm part of the Young European Federalists, so okay. I know quite a few throughout Europe. It really depends where you go. It's a lot of people are pro-Europe, but they don't take it to the final step of saying, I'm pro a European country.
So are you saying that because if you look at the US right now, and they have so much dominance, and they have so many things, like militarily speaking, they dominate so much of the space, economically speaking, are you saying that maybe combining all the countries in the European Union would be a better counterweight to the US in terms of force and strength, maybe even militarily speaking?
I mean, I don't believe that our goal should ever be to rival the United States. We are partners, and I hope to return to that state as soon as Trump disappears. But already now, well, disappears, as in he doesn't get selected. I don't want to insinuate anything else.
Well, I mean, let's hope that he doesn't follow through on his third term goals. You never know what will happen.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at it on the other hand, Europe employs more soldiers than the United States. We have more than 1 million soldiers when you also count reservists. We just have such an inefficient way of handling things. We have more than 500 different operating systems. We have different tanks, different ammunitions. So we are throwing money out of the window, which the United States, through economy of weight, of size, is pulling together and creating far more meaningful things. And for me, Europe is mainly, and that's what I firmly believe in, the United States of Europe, even though I'm a federalist, should be a long time goal. It should be something like, let's say, 2100, when we're old, when we're going to enjoy our new pension system, that day we'll have a future European Federation. But until that point, let's take logical steps together. The euro, the Schengen, those were logical steps which improved our daily lives, which made budgets easier. And there's so many more steps, be it education, health, military, and otherwise, where it doesn't take much. But if we found political courage, we could build a closer union which could actually respond to the kind of threats we're facing as democracy.
I think there's a point to be made, of course, that, you know, strength in numbers, that if you have, you know, more people in your union, then obviously that would be an advantage. But would this include every country in Europe, every country in the European Union? What do you do with countries like Hungary, who I would imagine would never go for this? You know, those are very nationalistic, protectionist countries that would say, no, we want to keep our culture. We don't want everything to be homogenized and be the same. We want to keep our distinct identity. So wouldn't you think that's a challenge?
Absolutely. I'd say, I mean, the problem is, and that's also a point I agree on, the European Union is built on united in diversity. So what one has to, whatever happens, what one has to ensure is that however integrated we become, we do not push away certain cultures, but that we become a mix of cultures and celebrate everyone's culture. That's the goal which we have to work towards. And the moment when it becomes something different, then it's not a European project anymore. Because being European is being this mix of everything we have to offer on our continent. But what I believe in on a political sense is that what one has to build is not a European Union as we have now, where everyone goes forward together at the same pace, which has its advantages, but also means that certain people, certain countries are pushed forward, even though they might not be ready yet, but a Europe of different speeds. So for example, Western Europe, the Benelux countries, we could easily integrate far further and have direct benefits for everyone in all of Western Europe. But then take Hungary, take Slovakia, you've got certain countries who don't want that. And that's their rights. I mean, they have their own sovereignty. So every country should be able to decide at which point they want to integrate.
Wouldn't that create a lot of, you know, imagine, you know, you'd had Luxembourg, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, and they would all form a union, but then you'd have, you know, isolated countries that would be sort of like be excluded. Isn't that some sort of pressure from us or from the union to them in terms of join or you're going to die economically, culturally, and all other sense?
I would tend to disagree, because you would, by becoming a union with some, you wouldn't annul the treaties with others. So, for example, as of now, what's funny is we already have a Europe of different speeds, just on a different level. We've got the Schengen, we've got the Euro, we've got the EU, we've got the EFTA, we've got the European political community. It goes on and on and on. I've actually bought a poster with all the alliances. It almost didn't fit on a more than 1 meter poster. But the fact is, if one were to build a coherent kind of pyramid structure where you've got the most integrated, these are the ones who share one political federation, political system, army, whatever. And then each step down, you have a bit less, but still integrated. So, for example, this guy here, Hungary takes the euro, takes Schengen, takes being part of political discussions in certain cases, but does not want to fully integrate and leaves that to others. So you still got the economic, the cultural, and the political advantages, you just don't have the last step. And this last step is what's so hard for some countries. But again, I mean, I'm speaking in hypothetical.
Sure, that's an interesting idea, for sure.
Yeah. I believe the main problem, though, and that's the one thing Europe has to solve at one point, is simply the veto. Because as of now, we don't have a European constitution. We don't have any advancements in the whole European project. What I like to say is, in the 20th century, what Europe did was monumental. What we've done since then is administrative. And that's because of the veto. Because a single country, I mean, Luxembourg, not even a million citizens, could block a union of more than 400 million citizens. And that's, for me, the big issue we face. And I take an historical, I'm a history buff, so I take a historical example from them for that. There was once the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, where there was the Liberum Vetum, which meant that even if a single politician, if the Chamber of Deputies would disagree, a law would not be voted. What did the Russians do? The Russians bought a single one of their deputies and asked him to vote against the declaration of war against Russia. And so Russia was able to just take certain provinces, I'm simplifying, of course, but certain provinces without problem. And we've got a similar situation. The last Russia sanctions package was not voted through because of Hungary and Slovakia.
Are you talking about the NATO right now or about the European Union?
The European sanctions package. So in the European Union, there's a veto, which means that a single country can block in some cases. There's a lot of legal stuff behind it, when they can use it, when they can't. In some cases, they can just say no. And their no is for the whole alliance. And so in that sense, a single no can block everyone, which of course can have absolutely disastrous effects.
Mm-hmm. And then just to kind of like, because we haven't really talked about the elephant in the room, which is the United States, right? Because you mentioned it, always been an ally, historically speaking, of course, and it's obviously in our best interest to keep the United States as an ally. So how do we survive the, what is it, 3 more years of the Trump administration? I fear that all the bridges are burned by the end of it, and we won't get back to this, you know, ally, this powerful ally, the relationships that we built with this powerful ally over so many years. So what is your view on that?
So we are only through 10% of Donald Trump's second mandate, so it's not necessarily encouraging. But I would say there is a deep friendship between the American and European people. There's deep business ties. There's also deep political ties. So I absolutely see the potential for rebound of the American-European relationship as happened during the beginning of Joe Biden. But what Europe has to realize, and I hope that they're doing it right now, we're doing it right now, is the Americans never had our best interests in mind. When they did the Marshall Plan, they invested in us in the sense of that we would pay their industry for them to come to rebuild Europe, promoting American industry and giving them a lot of influence in Europe. When Joe Biden did the Inflation Reduction Act, Joe Biden, where everyone thought he would be the best European ally there could be, at the moment where the Ukraine war started, where our industry was in the gutters, he suddenly massively invested in his own economy, leading to all of their enterprises outperforming ours. So what we've had is an American friend, certainly, who's taken care of our defense, certainly, but always to selfish purposes. And in the international deal, absolutely, absolutely. And so in that sense, what's happened now is just that it's become so much clearer. Trump does not have the diplomatic nuance to tell us, well, you have to do it your own. He says it blatantly in our face. And honestly, I see it as good, because if we cannot depend on ourselves, if we don't have this autonomy as a continent to say we're going to protect ourselves, I find it hypocritical. And in that sense, I even agree with him. We have these wonderful countries. We have Luxembourg, which is amazing in most senses. I mean, I like to bicker about it as much as any Luxembourger. But what we have are beautiful countries. If we are not ready to defend what we've built here, then why should the Americans do it? And so in that sense, I agree with them.
Does it show a little bit our dependency on the US also, now that the relation is a little rocky. It's like, oh no, what would actually happen if we couldn't rely on the US anymore? It actually reveals that we might not be prepared for any type of crisis that might arise.
I mean, I don't believe that if the Americans would go for it, that we would absolutely be defenseless. I mean, Russia only has a GDP which is as big as Italy's. So it's not as though we're completely defenseless. But the main point is, who would be in charge? Like, if the Americans go away, would it be the British who would help us or be the guide in the war? Well, no, they had Brexit.
Yeah, not after Brexit, yeah.
Yeah. Who would want Macron to lead it? Would it be the Germans? Oh, we don't like the historical connotations. So you've got a leaderless Europe, and that's our main issue. The moment where we find a political structure where we have a clear person guiding the continent, or not necessarily person, but right now, I mean, on the European level, you've got three people who are able to call themselves presidents. You've got multiple institutions working with each other and against each other, depending the day. So we do not have a coherent Europe. But the moment where we build a Europe which has a clear vision and a clear institutions guiding them, that moment I believe that a giant will awake. Because we've got the GDP, the population, the institutions, the political history and so forth, the talents, the strategy to absolutely become a major player. And I don't believe that we have to become someone like the United States who has to intervene everywhere. But we absolutely have the defenses and the capabilities to defend our interests at home. And for me, that's the most important, that we Europeans can defend what we Europeans have built over centuries.
I mean, this is quite interesting. I love having these conversations. I feel like in Luxembourg, they don't happen often enough. And it's a little bit more like you probably alluded to earlier. Oftentimes, you know, conversations are curated, you know, they're well done, but maybe don't involve everyone. They don't really go as deep and they're not as engaging as they could be, which is why I find it fascinating that you at your young age are really engaged in a political process. And I hope that you can inspire other people to come with you, and I think it's a great thing for me.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on this podcast. It's been an amazing discussion.
Absolutely, and I look forward to see what you'll be able to do on the political field in the future years.
Thank you very much.